Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 6th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is our presenter, Barbara Rossing. Today's session number is 99-2, and it is titled Revelation 2, Promising the Tree of Life, Seven Letters. And let's listen to Barbara.
Here. Welcome, everybody. This is the second in a Bible study series on the book of Revelation, which is my specialty, and we're looking at it this week from different angles. Were most of you here yesterday? Okay, why don't I just review a little bit of what I talked about yesterday, because it was kind of a funny day anyway, and we had to leave early because of the 4th of July stuff. What I'm suggesting is some strategies that will help you read the book of Revelation. Now, let me say again, first of all, there are multiple ways to read the book of Revelation. The dominant one in our culture, by far, has been the sort of fundamentalist or literalist take on it, that was popularized first in the 19th century in America, and we can see how it continues through Hal Lindsey. Yesterday we read a news story about this series of novels called Left Behind, that I don't know if you're seeing, they're on the tops of the best-selling religious book charts, that take literally this idea of a chronology or a script for the end times that includes a rapture and a period of 7 years of tribulation, a literal thousand-year millennial reign, and then this literal second coming. That's one way to read Revelation. But I'm suggesting a more metaphorical approach to Revelation I'm going to lay out this week that doesn't read it in such a literalistic or script for the end times kind of way. So I suggested, first of all, get a little bit of knowledge of the history of interpretation of Revelation, know how recent that whole business that now seems to be the dominant way of reading is, know how American it is. People in other countries and other cultures don't read Revelation in the same way. So that'll help you feel like you're a little bit more empowered when you come up against fundamentalists. I've got, and I'll use a little bit later today, Martin Luther's prefaces to the book of Revelation, because in a sense, I think he's a classic example twice of how not to read Revelation. So that'll empower you, too, to realize how our very own beloveds, how disputed Revelation has been. That's what I would say, how diverse the interpretations have been and how disputed it's been. Second thing, and maybe this is the most important, is read Revelation with the heart of a poet or an artist. We heard yesterday at the 4th of July celebrations so much wonderful poetry and literature. This is how to approach the book of Revelation, with an imagination. Part of the reason Revelation has been so disputed is it's a question of what you read literally or literalistically and what you read metaphorically. We tend to think, because we're so influenced by fundamentalism, that unless you read something literally, you're saying it's not true. So the fundamentalist approach to the Bible has been read everything literally, take it all literally, because that's what it means to take it seriously. And I think what our parishes and everybody most needs is a sense of freedom to read things as metaphors, not literally. So much of the Bible is metaphorical. It's beautiful poetic language. From Isaiah, for example, the mountains and the hills will break into singing and all the trees will clap their hands. It's a beautiful passage, right? But, I mean, you know, how many days have you looked at these mountains now? Have you seen them break forth into singing, literally? No. Except in the 4th of July parade yesterday where everybody was dressed up as trees, you haven't seen trees clap their hands either, right? It's metaphors. You know, it's an evocative way of speaking about things that's poetic, but it's not meant to be taken literally. That's what I'm arguing. But again, I'll say this is only one take on the book of Revelation, and you can certainly hear others out there. The mandate for this, though, is the central image of the book of Revelation is the image for Jesus Christ as a lamb. It's a beautiful image. And you sang it in the liturgy Sunday night, you know, worthy is Christ, the lamb who was slain. Why do we call Jesus a lamb? I mean, why would you do that? Why use that metaphor? What does it do for you? Why would you like that? Anybody?
Docile and gentle. Gentle.
Gentle, uh-huh.
Pure,
peaceful. Yeah, peaceful like a lamb. Others?
Sacrifice.
Okay, when Jesus is called a lamb, that it invokes the whole Old Testament tradition of the, especially the book of Exodus. And I think that's really central to understanding Revelation. In the Exodus tradition, it was the blood of the lamb painted on the doorpost that saved the Israelites, that got Pharaoh finally to let them go. So by situating Jesus in that tradition of the sacrificial lamb, it invokes rich, rich memories of Old Testament Exodus traditions and sacrifice. The scapegoat traditions there, where in the wilderness they could lay all their sins on one poor goat and send him off into the wilderness, and then everybody was forgiven. Any other stuff with lambs? Isaiah 53, you look in that, and there's the image of the suffering servant as a vulnerable lamb. I mean, it's a rich, rich image, right? We like to think of Jesus as a lamb. But you can't take it literally. That's the important thing. I mean, even the most radical of New Testament scholars, you know, in the Jesus, what is it called? The Jesus
seminar.
Nobody tries to argue that Jesus was literally a sheep. You know, I mean, they might say, it's just, it's a metaphor, but it's a beautiful one. And I want to argue with you that a lot of the imagery of Revelation that tends to be taken literally, like a millennium of 1,000 years, a lot of the years, the colors, the numbers, the symbols, it's not a literal script for end times so much as it is evocative, metaphorical, poetic language. But as we go through the week, feel free to challenge me, because I am going to, in fact, argue that some stuff should be read more literally, namely the critique of the Roman Empire. I'm going to point to some places that I think there is literal stuff. But that's the whole debate with Revelation, is what's literal and what's metaphorical. But I think the more you can get your poetic hat on, the more you can think imaginatively and poetically and metaphorically, the more you'll be able to enter the world of vision of Revelation. That's a different world of vision. It's a very different kind of book from what we're used to.
But isn't some of the poetry not so beautiful? I mean,
yes.
There's poetic stuff that may be metaphorical, but it's also scary.
Yes. And in fact, we're going to talk about that whole issue today. That's the rhetoric of vilification and what you do with that. Yeah, it sounds vengeful and scary. Exactly. This can read like a really violent book. I heard Al Gore talk one time after he had written his, I can't remember, Earth in the Balance, his book about environmental stuff. And he was telling about the mutations that have happened in the southern hemisphere where the ozone hole is the worst. And he said, it's like a nature hike through the book of Revelation. You know, I mean, there's that aspect of Revelation. It's ugly and violent, or seems to be, and I want to talk about that. But so what I'm arguing, basically, it's not a code that you figure out. It's not like equations that you solve where each of the symbols means something. Rather, it has multiple meanings, multiple valences. It's multivalent and very rich. So be prepared to be poetic. And for those of us who grew up as scientists, that's hard, but you got to try. The third thing I suggested is use a sense of literary genres. Revelation identifies for you in the opening verses some of the genres it's following. Prophecy is named in verse 3, and that's prophecy not in the sense of predicting future events like people talk about prophecy today, you know, where you open the horoscope to find out what your day is going to be, but it's prophecy in the sense of God's proclamation of judgment and salvation and calling people to this vision of God's future. And it's apocalypse, that's the very first word of the book, and we talked about the genre of apocalypse here, literary genre. And again, I mean, you know as much as I do about literary genres. I was not an English major. I don't know anything about them. But English majors tell us this is a really important thing. So there's at least three genres operating, probably more. But there's prophecy in the sense of grounding revelation in the Old Testament. There's apocalypse. And this is this idea that was common to Jewish, Christian, and classical texts, Greco-Roman texts, where someone goes on a journey up into heaven. It can be space travel or down into the underworld or out into the future or back into the past. So we talked about how the Christmas Carol is in some ways Scrooge going on his own little apocalypse. The difference is that in the biblical tradition, apocalypses are more community-based. Scrooge's was individualistic. These are more communal. But anyway, apocalypse is an important genre. So you look at the conventions that are used in these genres. And then a third one that we're going to talk more about today is the genre of letters. it's following that pattern. You could add other genres like hymns. There's a lot going on in Revelation, specific forms that are used. But part of then how you study the book is to see how it follows these patterns and then where it departs from the patterns. And those might be significant. Then I said we're going to follow Revelation, especially through the eyes of marginalized people in our world today, which means looking outside of the United States. Some very important commentaries on the book. This one that I'm using from Chile, especially by a guy named Pablo Richard. Also a South African one here called Comfort and Protest by Alan Bozak that reads Revelation. It was a very important commentary when it was written in the 80s. When the South African state was looking at Romans 13, which says government is instituted by God, you've got to obey government, and they use this as a kind of state theology for saying that what is the apartheid regime is God's intended government for this society, then South African Christians looked rather to Revelation 13, two very different chapters, Romans 13 and Revelation 13, and they found a different vision of government, namely that government is satanic and that sometimes Christians are called to resist government. And that, I think, shows the diversity of different perspectives, ethical perspectives we've got in the New Testament. Revelation is a fringe book, no doubt about it. It's on the edge of the canon in terms of coming at the end. And politically, it's way out there. I don't know whether to say it's right-wing or left-wing or what, but it's definitely on the margins. But sometimes we need that political perspective. And I think what the book of Revelation can do for us now, politically anyway, is to call us to account for all the ways that we've become very much conformed to our culture. Revelation is a countercultural book, if nothing else. It's saying Christians have to resist culture and resist government. And maybe we need to hear that witness right now. That's what this book will offer us. We'll see. And then I'm also going to argue this week and next week in the Bible studies I'm going to do on Bible and ecology that this book offers us some interesting and intriguing ecological resources if you sort of have to read between the lines in some ways, because I think the New Jerusalem vision is one of the most earth-centered visions in all of Scripture. The last strategy I didn't get to yesterday, but I want to emphasize this one as we get into the book now, read Revelation with a sense of humor. I think it's there in the book, and I'll point out some of that. But I think that when Revelation tends to get really bogged down and we tend to decide this book isn't worth it, you know, just forget it. It's got too much potency for vilifying people and stuff. What can kind of welcome you back is all the funny cartoons in the New Yorker magazine or whatever, you know, where you've got plays on 666. I saw one just a couple months ago. As I was planting my garden, you know, you go to the store and you're deciding between your perennials and your annuals. Well, this New Yorker cartoon had three slots in the greenhouse. It was the annuals, the perennials, and the millennials. So, but anyway, have a sense of humor about Revelation and don't take those numbers too seriously. You can have a lot of fun with them if you lighten it up a little bit. Okay. Let's take a look just a little bit more at chapter one, and then I want to get into those seven letters. Because we talked about the genre of prophecy in verse three and apocalypse in verse one. Verse four, you see him setting out this letter pattern, the third one here. In the ancient world, they wrote letters more like what we write our memos, only you put the sender's name first, so it would be like Barbara to the seven churches that are in Asia. That's how he starts out here. John to the seven churches that are in Asia. Grace and peace to you from the one who is and who was and who is to come. Which sounds like one of Paul's letters, very much like one of Paul's letters. In fact, he might have been using this tradition consciously. He's writing a good generation and a half after Paul, knows that those letters are have been written to some of these same churches. He seems to be using that pattern then. What this means, when you see letters in the New Testament, as much of the New Testament is, you're reading somebody else's mail. Basically. Has anyone ever read someone else's mail? Don't ever send postcards from Holden unless you want people reading them, or get postcards. I'll just tell you that, having lived here over the years. No, we've all read other people's mail. I mean, admit it. It's fun. But And these get published. I mean, I like reading books of letters from so-and-so to so-and-so. It's very interesting. Just recently, a book of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's letters to his fiancée came out. I mean, this is an important place to find theology sometimes is in letters. A lot of important historical stuff. But when you do that, I mean, what's fascinating about letters, part of it is you try to find out about these people and about their particular situation. So the books of the Bible, I mean, to me, the richness unfolds when you read them, not as kind of timeless truths only, but also about the particulars. And with the book of Revelation, same thing. It's a particular person writing at a particular time. We think about the year 95, towards the end of the reign of the Emperor Domitian, and writing to specific places in a most beautiful corner of the world. How many of you have been to the seven churches or been to Turkey, been on your cruise? Okay, what's it like?
It's
gorgeous. Mm-hmm.
It's lovely. Some parts of it.
Some parts of it, okay.
Ephesus is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
It was a gorgeous city at one time.
Yeah, it was. And it used to be located right on the harbor. Now, interestingly, and next week I want to talk some more about this, but this week also about, for some reason, because of deforestation or whatever in the ancient world, the harbors of Asia Minor have silted up, and Ephesus, which used to be a port city, is now located about a mile inland. That's how far things have gotten silted up. I think it has something to do with all the tree cutting that happened in the ancient world, and I'm doing some work on that. But these are beautiful cities. Where didn't you like, Peggy?
What's the question?
Which ones didn't you like?
Why didn't all of them? This was a tour that only ended up, we were at Ephesus.
Oh, okay.
And it was just very exciting to walk where Paul had been. And
yeah.
Be in the amphitheater. And because of the silting up that you described, the whole city was abandoned.
Uh-huh.
And they had to move it someplace else because the economy was gone. So it got buried over the centuries. So they've been able to dig and recover an ancient city that hasn't been lived in for a while.
Yeah, and it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Huge, right? You take a look at the theater in Ephesus, it could seat 60,000. These are urban settings, large, large cities of the Roman Empire, beautifully preserved. If you get a chance to go, it's a great place, cheap, beautiful beaches. I'm not even going to draw a map, though, I realize, because if there's people who've been here, then I'm going to massacre it. But anyway, these are actual cities of Asia Minor that were by this time Romanized and colonized by Rome. Ephesus is the largest, but Pergamon was also big. Pergamon sits on a high hill, beautifully preserved, fabulous to visit. And John is writing to specific churches in their situation. Now, we don't think, okay, I want to skip over to chapters 2 and 3 now and show you these seven letters. Unlike Paul's letters, we don't think they were actually sent separately to these seven churches. So that's a difference. You know, whereas we think that Paul actually sent the Corinthian letters to Corinth and the Philippians letter to Philippi, and then later they were put together into a letter collection. Most scholars think that these seven letters of Revelation were always intended to be written as a collection, that all the churches would read all seven letters, which is sort of like if the parent has seven kids and puts them all in the same room and gives them each an encouragement and a scold, and they all overhear each other's, you know, what is said to the other kids sticks with you as well. So that's how the seven letters are. They're meant to be read as a unit. But they are written to these specific churches. And the more we can learn about that situation, I think the more we'll be able to enter the world of Revelation and understand the situation for which it's written. Actually, why don't I just back up to one more verse in chapter 1. I'm sorry, chapter 1, verse 9. This is where he gives us a little bit of his situation. I, John, your brother, who share with you in Jesus the tribulation. Now, you might have different translations. This is the Greek word thlipsis. I guess the new RSV has persecution here. Is that right? But I think it's better to leave it vague. We don't know what he meant by tribulation. Because tribulation, or this word thlipsis, can be used for everything from medical problems. I mean, when Paul had his thorn in the flesh, whatever his medical problem was, he called that thlipsis. When other people had other kinds of problems, they called it thlipsis. So it can be persecution, but it also can be other kinds of tribulation, more broadly defined. I share with you the tribulation and the empire. I'm using that translation. That's how Wes Howard Brook, who was here last week, translates the Greek word basileia. You can translate it as kingdom, but it seems to have a political connotation here. He's starting into laying out the political landscape within which he's working. and the patient endurance. I was on the island called Patmos. Did you go there, Peggy? Did you go to Patmos?
Not to Patmos.
No, I haven't been there either. Anybody been to Patmos?
No.
Well, it's supposed to be wonderful. We'll have to go there. Anyway, that's an island off the coast of Asia Minor. And he says he's there on account of the Word of God. Again, we don't know what that means. We're all here on the account of the Word of God, right, here at Holden? So it could be just going on a retreat, or it could be exile. We don't know what's going on. The tradition has been that he's been exiled to Patmos under some kind of a political imprisonment, but we don't know if that's the case. Anyway, he's separated from his churches, so he's writing them letters because he can't be there in person. And that's where he's laying out the situation. Okay, let's look at those seven letters. They're starting in chapter 2, and this is the one that promises the tree of life. This is the really wonderful one. I think this is why this book is so good for the Holden summer theme, is what John does in the seven letters here is lay out these promises that then get picked up in the final vision of the book, the New Jerusalem vision, chapters 21 and 22, where we actually enter the world of God's city, which on Friday I'll look at with you and see how it might empower us for our own ministry in urban situations and in the world today. If we think of it as an earth-centered vision of God's future, then what does it say to us? But the promises of the things that we're going to find in New Jerusalem are set up here in the seven letters to the seven churches. And they all follow a sort of formulaic pattern. There's some deviations in the pattern. I've got a handout if a few of you want this afterwards. I don't know. I seem to have left a lot of them in my car or something. I only have 10 copies, but I can give you a handout. Or we can just go through it here, too. Would somebody be willing to read chapter 2, verses 1 to 7? This is the first letter, the letter to Ephesus, that sort of lays out the pattern.
To the angel of the church in Ephesus write, this is the message from the one who holds the seven stars in his right hand and who walks among the seven gold lampstands. I know what you have done. I know how hard you have worked and how patiently you have been. I know that you cannot tolerate evil men and that you have tested those who say they are apostles but are not and have found out that they are liars. You are patient, you have suffered for my sake, and you have not given up. But this is what I have against you. You do not love me now as you did at first. Think how far you have fallen. Turn from your sins and do what you did at first. If you don't turn from your sins, I will come to you and take your lampstand from its place. But this is what you have in your favor. You hate what the Nicolaitans do as much as I do. If you have ears, then listen to what the Spirit says to the churches. To those who win the victory, I will give the right to eat the fruit of the tree of life that grows in the garden of God.
Huh. What translation are you using?
This is New English. Today's English.
Okay, I think that's a paraphrase.
Oh.
But it has some wonderful stuff. Namely, I mean, what's really interesting is in that last line, this is an interesting one. It's true. In Greek, the same word for garden is also the word for paradise. A lot of you probably had paradise as she was reading, right? It's the Greek word paradisos, and it means garden. So think of that the next time you're out in your garden. You're out in a little swath of paradise there. It's the same Greek word. Great. Yeah, wonderful. And then what did you have for before that to the one who is victorious?
To those who win the victory.
Win the victory, yeah. Well, that works too. It's the Greek word, the verb is what we get Nike tennis shoes from. You know, Nike is the goddess for victory. So the verb is nikao. So it's the one who's victorious or the one who conquers. Yeah, good. Okay. Well, anyway, you see the pattern here of the letters. They start out to the angel of the church, and then they give the name of the town here. And you could chart it if you want to get serious about this. You don't have to get serious at home because you're on vacation, but you can't. Then you would do, you know, each town, how it follows the pattern of, you know, you do Ephesus, then Smyrna, like this, you know, and chart them down and see how they follow. Because in each one, et cetera, for seven letters, to the angel of the church in such and such a town, X, in this case it's Ephesus, We don't know why he says angel of the church of such and such. Some have argued that it's pastor of the church. I don't think that, because I think in the book of Revelation there aren't any pastors. There's prophets, but there's not pastors. And we're all called priests in Revelation. It's a very different kind of church structure from what we're used to. Somebody said it's the pastor's wife. I don't know.
The secretary.
The secretary, that's it. Okay, well, anyway. And the Greek word angel also means messenger. So it could be to the messenger of the church in Ephesus, right? So that's the address. And then there's a description of Christ. We didn't look at this in chapter 1, but in chapter 1, there's a description of Jesus as the one who has hair like wool, legs of burnished bronze, who has a two-edged sword coming out of his mouth. It's kind of a wild description. I'm going to show an overhead tomorrow of Martin Luther's depiction of this in a kind of literalistic way. Very difficult to show. But anyway, the different elements of that are picked up in these seven letters. In this case, it's from the one who holds the seven stars in his hand and walks among the seven lampstands. Then there's the diagnosis in each of these letters. And he starts out in most of them at least with some praise. And there's different amounts of praise and blame in the letters. The second and sixth one have mostly praise, and the others have lots of blame. But Smyrna and Philadelphia get off pretty easily. Ephesus, though, he starts out by saying, I know your works. It's a very works-oriented book. In a sense, Lutherans have found it alien because of that, but we can do good works too. I know your works, your toil, your patient endurance, and how you cannot bear evildoers, but have tested those who call themselves apostles but are not, and have found them to be false. This is all to your credit. I know you're enduring patiently, bearing up for my name's sake. You haven't grown weary. But then he says, but then I have this against you. And that's how all the letters go. There's some praise and some blame. And now starts the blame. I've got this against you. You've abandoned. And this is where I think your translation maybe is not so good. Because I think you've abandoned the love you had at first. It's not necessarily love for God, but it could be love for the community as well. But, of course, our translations vary here. So then there's the call for repentance. Remember then from what you have fallen. Repent and do the works that you did at first. And then there's a threat. If not, I will remove your lampstand. Then he goes back to more praise and blame. I mean, they don't follow this pattern rigidly. And this is what I want to look at today, is how we praise and blame one another and label one another. Because as you said, Barb, there's stuff about Revelation that's really scary and dangerous. And some of it is right here in the seven letters, the way John vilifies those Christians with whom he disagrees. And I want to talk about that whole issue with our communities and churches. Because here he says, yet you've got this to your credit. You hate the works of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. So, you know, you hate the same people as I hate. That's good. And then comes the hearing formula. Let the one who has ears hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. That's in all these seven letters. And then a promise. And this is where we get the tree of life. All these letters end with a promise. To the one who is victorious, or to the one who overcomes, I will give X. And then each of the letters gives some kind of a promise. And in this case, it's I will give permission to eat of the fruit of the tree of life, which is in the garden or paradise of God. And this is an amazing promise, because in Genesis, you know, Adam and Eve were kicked out of the Garden of Eden so that they wouldn't eat of the tree of life and live forever after they'd eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So now to promise that to those who continue faithfully through whatever it is, the middle chapters of Revelation, basically, you will get permission to eat of the fruit of the tree of life. This is wonderful. And this is how John sets up the letter. And we're going to see the structure of Revelation is such that the promises that are laid out in these opening chapters, chapter 2 and 3, then come to fulfillment in the New Jerusalem vision at the end of the book. So they carry you through all the middle scary sections with the trumpets and the bowls and the seals. And of course, after yesterday, we'll never be scared of the seven seals again. Hopefully. Okay, so that's the pattern of all seven letters, and you can look at any of them. Let's take a look at Pergamon, the third letter. We'll skip over Smyrna. Not so interesting because it's all praise. You know, we want to look at the blame. Okay, so starting in verse 12. To the angel of the church in Pergamon, right? So it's that same pattern there with the address. The words of the one who has the sharp two-edged swords. This is a recollection of the description of Jesus that was in chapter 1 a little bit, a different separate bit of it. It's highly structured here, very closely patterned here. Then he says, I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. Now, some people think we should look at these letters for specific references to the archaeological evidence that we've got in these cities. I mean, there is a huge altar that that was found in Pergamon that some people say, oh, this must be what he's referring to, Satan's throne. It's actually beautiful. You won't find it in Pergamon anymore because the early archaeologists hauled it off to Germany, and it's in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. But if you ever get a chance to go to it, it is spectacular. It's enormous. It would fill up this room, beautifully carved with sculptures of reflecting the battles of the Amazons and the gods and the people and stuff. I mean, it's all of sort of Greek history in mythic form on this altar that was in a very prominent place in Pergamon. And that might be what this is referring to, although I think you have to be careful about making your one-to-one correspondences on something like this. Let's see, reading a little further, verse 14, but I've got a few things against you. You have some there who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, that they might eat food sacrificed to idols and practice immorality. What's this all about? Who's Balaam? Who's Balak?
Idol.
No, Old Testament characters. No. Back in the book of Numbers, we're not going to look at it right now, but you can look them up in Numbers 20 and Numbers 31. What did they do? Well, Balaam is the butt of many jokes because, the donkey, okay. Anyway, they were unfaithful people in the Old Testament. And what John is doing here, what he's starting into here, is using Old Testament labels to currently label Christians with whom he disagrees and use it as a way of vilifying them and their positions. Now, what are the issues? What is he so upset about? Eating food sacrificed to idols. What do you know about this? It comes up in other New Testament letters, like 1 Corinthians and Romans. Paul deals with it. Yeah.
It's not important.
Right. Paul says it's not so important.
Yeah. Depends on your attitude.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
You know, you look at what are the burning issues ethically for us today. I mean, maybe, I guess vegetarianism is still quite an issue given the treatment of animals and stuff. But that was the burning issue for early Christians, apparently, or one of them, is do Christians have to be vegetarians or not? And some said yes and some said no. There was a range of possible positions. The deal was if you were going to eat meat, it was necessarily meat that had been sacrificed in the market to pagan deities. So the question is this so much of an issue that you've got to never eat meat, or is it not a big deal? And people take different positions. You see Paul in 1 Corinthians saying, well, we know idols have no meaning anyway, so you know it's not that big a deal. But in Revelation, I mean, John is the Pat Buchanan of the New Testament. I mean, he really knows his opinions, and he knows what's right and what's wrong and who's wrong, and he's got labels for all those that he disagrees with. And eating meat is not something that he tolerates. And so the leaders in Pergamon that he disagrees with are those who teach people that it's okay to eat meat that has been sacrificed to idols. In other words, it's okay to eat meat. And John apparently thinks it's not okay. Uh-huh.
Are you saying that the majority of the animals that were killed at this time were ritualistically sacrificed?
All of them. Uh-huh. You couldn't get any meat that wasn't, it wasn't ritually, well, it was just part of the meat market. I mean, the different guilds had, it would be like if the only place you could buy meat was from the Lions Guild or something. I mean, that was just part of what was, how it was done. The slaughterers of meat were... So yeah, that was the issue. You couldn't get meat any other way in these cities. And so Christians disagree on whether you can do it or not. I mean, I think that's what we need to see in Revelation, is there's disagreements. And the question is only one possible position legitimately right or not? That's the struggle with this book, and where I think we need to resist what Revelation does as far as vilifying people that you disagree with.
Barbara?
Uh-huh.
Well, what about, say, the diaspora community in Ephesus? Surely... And they had land or something that wasn't...
Okay. The Jewish community, yeah, they must have had some way, and we don't know enough about them to know what was going on as far as how Jews dealt with this issue here. But there also seems to be a break at this point, very, very painful break, between the Christian communities and the Jewish communities. Because in one of the letter to Philadelphia, it talks about who is the true synagogue and who's truly a Jew or not. So apparently Christians no longer had that. There was a split. They're fighting battles on two different fronts, apparently, very marginalized in that sense, yeah. But Jews had to struggle with this issue as well, certainly. Okay, the other thing that he names here as the problem that is so bad that he's got to call these people Balaam and Balak is this practicing immorality. The Greek word is porneia. I don't know what translations you've got there, the second.
Sexual immorality.
Sexual immorality? What else?
Fornication.
Okay, there's a debate here. I think most scholars would argue that this one is metaphorical, whereas the meat-eating one is literally critiquing something. People would suggest that there wasn't actually rampant sexual activity going on in these churches, as far as we know, but it was rather the Old Testament critique of idolatry. So it goes back to these idols again. In the Old Testament, Israel was considered married to God. Israel's God's wife. So if you followed pagan gods, then it was like committing adultery. So that was often in the Old Testament prophets, Jeremiah, Hosea, Ezekiel, that was often called sexual immorality. So that might be what's going on here, is the metaphorical rather than literal take on this. But anyway, we don't know. So he's saying, repent from this, else I will war against you with the sword of my mouth. He's always got some threat. And then again, the hearing formula, let the one who has an ear hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will give some of the manna and a white stone with a new name written on it, which no one knows except the one who receives it. So that's Pergamon. Okay, Thyatira, let's look quickly at this one, because this one is really problematic, I think, as far as this pattern of vilification of others. Because, I mean, nobody makes much of the label Balaam or Balak today, right? I mean, if you said to somebody, you know, when you're playing with them and, you know, as a little kid and you disagreed with them, you know, you Balaam, that doesn't exactly mean anything, right? But Jezebel does, right? What does it mean if you say to someone, you Jezebel? What is it? Whore?
Traitor.
A slut? A what?
Traitor.
Traitor? Okay, yeah, that sort of combination of political machinations and sexual overtones that are all very, very scary. This is what John's doing in the letter to Thyatira. It's very interesting. He says in verse 19, I know your works, your love and faith and service, your patient endurance, that your latter works exceed the first. So this is the praise. But I have this against you, that you tolerate that woman Jezebel. Apparently, in the city of Thyatira, in the Christian church, there's a faction of the congregation, maybe even the majority part of the congregation, that is led by a woman. Very interesting. A woman prophet. Now, her name was surely not Jezebel. This is an Old Testament label that John is putting on her. Again, doing like he did with the Balaam and the Balak thing. He disagrees with her, so he's labeling her as a Jezebel. And he says she calls herself a prophet. And she's teaching and beguiling my servants to practice, again, this same stuff, whatever this porneia is, however you want to take it, metaphorically or literally. And she's teaching and beguiling my servants to eat this food that is sacrificed to idols. So again, it's the same issue. It's the question that was a burning one in the early church of how much do you accommodate yourself to culture? How much to participate in the pagan culture and how much to resist? And that was a debate. There was a whole continuum of perspectives. I mean, we have that same thing today. The Mennonites, the Amish, would say you've really got to resist culture. Others of us, Lutherans, you know, we're off the scale on the accommodationists. We basically become those who participate fully in culture. This was the problem, you know, during the Nazi regime, is like Lutherans and Catholics were same as everybody else, you know, practically no resistance to culture. And you can look at books in the New Testament and put them on a continuum of sort of the level to which they say participate. And some of them say you've got to participate in culture maybe as a strategy to stay alive. But John even says, no, don't do that. I mean, he's a real nonconformist. That's part of what makes this book such a fringe book, but also part of what has been the message of hope for so many who feel so marginalized in the world, who are living under oppression, who hear the call to resistance as a call to hope. And that's what the book of Revelation is a real saying. You've got to resist culture. You cannot participate in these institutions, in the meat market, or wherever it is that call you to make compromises for the sake of accommodation to culture and to government. And he's really calling for resistance here. So that's why he says you can't follow this woman prophet, whoever she is, and he calls her a Jezebel, because she says it's okay to eat this meat, and it isn't. Now, why don't we just stop here for a moment? Whoa. Because what I want to talk about is how in our churches we tend to use these same strategies of vilifications too often, in my opinion. I mean, there's aspects of Revelation that I think are really liberating and that are really hope-filled and that we need today. And I think we do need to hear the call to not be conformed to this world. But the question is there a way that we can do that without labeling and vilifying those in our churches with whom we disagree? Because Revelation has certainly been used as a weapon. It's an easy way to vilify your opponents. Why don't I just end with this by saying Martin Luther himself was an example of this. I've got a few copies, if one of you wants it, Luther's two prefaces to the book of Revelation. Because I think he's a good example of how not to read the book. In his first preface in 1522, he wrote prefaces to all the New Testament books. The first time around, he said, as he did about the book of Jude, right above it, he says, book of Jude, it's not an epistle that needs to be counted as central to the New Testament. Book of Revelation, he says, well, about this book, I leave everyone free to hold their own opinions. Don't be bound by my opinion or judgment, because I say what I feel. But in my opinion, Christ is neither taught nor known in this book. So my spirit cannot accommodate itself to this book. So he basically says, ignore it. And that's your first Lutheran approach, generally. We've all followed that one pretty successfully, right? And that's fine. I mean, because Lutherans operate with a canon within the canon, and the canon is the message of grace and justification by faith. And by those kinds of criteria, Revelation is not as central. But I'm glad it made it in the New Testament. I think it's a really important book. But he's legitimate, I think, in saying, you know, be careful of some of these books. Jude, I'd agree with him on that one. Second time around, though, by 1546, he rediscovered the power of Revelation, a very important book. He rediscovered the power of Revelation used as a weapon to vilify your opponents. And the way you do this is by read it as a script. Read it as code language, and you're meant to figure out who it is that's encoded in all these evil characters. You know, you've got unlimited numbers of ugly-looking insects. You know, we had the six-winged creature yesterday in the parade. You know, you've got all your various evil creatures and stuff, the beast, the whore. You just, quote, figure out who they are, and they're the people that you love to hate. So that's what... Luther does here. I mean, he says the second evil angel is Martian, the Montanists, the third is Origen, the fourth is Novatus. These are all people through Christian history that we love to hate. You figure out that the three woes, you label them the Mohammedans. He didn't like the Turks. He didn't know any Turks, but he didn't like them. He didn't like Jews, you know, so he puts those in. And you use it as a script for vilifying your opponents. Most of all, he didn't like the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church. So he figures out that all the beasts, no surprise, the beast from the land and the beast from the sea, both of them are the Pope. The Whore of Babylon is the Pope. You know, it's no surprise. And he reads it as kind of a script for how you use it to vilify your opponents. Now, that's not all he said. I mean, he does say this book is important for our comfort and for justice. It's worth reading his prefaces, but I think that's too often the way that Revelation has been used. And in fact, he says that at the very end. This is kind of amusing. He says, I lost my place here. But anyway, he says, much good use can be made of this book if you use it this way. And that's what we're doing, is using the book of Revelation when we use it to vilify others. My colleague at the Lutheran School of Theology, David Rhodes, has just written a book that I thought I donated to the Holden Library last year, so I got to find out what happened. But anyway, it's called The Challenge of Diversity, that I think is a really important book. I don't know if they've got it in the store this year. I used it last year. I taught out of it. And what David Rhodes argues is that in the New Testament, all the New Testament authors, or most of them, have this tendency to, as part of sort of putting forth their theology and making their arguments about God and Jesus and about how we are to live, they also lay out sort of a dualistic, like, this is the way that we should think and the way we should follow, and here's the danger side, and here's where the, you know, you go down the slippery slope. They all draw a line and say, beyond this is heresy. Beyond this is really evil. But David Rhodes argues that it, within the canon of the New Testament authors draw the line in so many different places that they sort of, in a way, can not cancel each other out, but that we can take the theologies of the different books of the New Testament without also having to follow the ways in which they vilify other Christians who hold to different opinions. And that the canon itself is a great embrace of diverse theological positions, a wide range of diverse positions. And so that even though John, for example, would draw the line right on this issue of eating meat and saying, you know, if you eat this meat that's been sacrificed in these meat markets, then you're, you know, going to hell, you're whatever. We know that Paul drew the line in a different place on this issue. And the challenge of the New Testament then is to embrace the diversity of these theological positions. And in our churches today, we can use this model of diversity as a way of not vilifying one another so much. So I guess I just want to throw that question out to you. You know, how can we hear the call of Revelation to a sort of radical nonconformist kind of position without, on the other side, also using the vilification? Or is it legitimate to separate those? Do we have to vilify our opponents? Or are there other models for how we can deal with disagreement in our congregation? Because clearly what he's got is factions in these churches, right? There's people in different camps. And has anyone ever had an experience of that in your communities? Has anyone ever had the book of Revelation used against you?
Well, it's interesting what you're saying about assigning each of those characters or roles to the people or the organizations that you want to vilify. I don't think that's what Wes was doing, but there's some of that in there in his discussions of who the empire is. And I think in every age, there's maybe a different villain that assumes that role.
Yeah, and we're certainly called to discern what it is. But it was interesting, in the 70s, for example, you had Revelation commentaries being written by Daniel Berrigan and William Stringfellow on the one hand, who said that Babylon is the United States, and then by your Hal Lindsey's and others on the other hand, who said that the Soviet Union is Babylon. You know, so we can use it for opposite political agendas, too. Now, I happen to agree with Wes Howard Brook, who was here last week. I mean, I think he's got a very important reading of Revelation in terms of the call to empire. But
but at the same time, thinking of Martin Luther's time in the Catholic Church, I think he probably had an even valid reason he saw for the Catholic Church in some way as that empire.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm wrestling with your question. It's a good, tough question to ask. You know, one thought that I have is that within the context of the Christian community, deal with differences of viewpoint or even oppositional attitude, the one thing to do is to draw the circle large enough so everyone's inside the circle to remind the community of what the community's for, its larger purpose, its mission. Sometimes can help if people are working in their higher minds. If they're not, then that's a whole other messy kind of a situation. And the second thing that comes to me, occurs to me, is that we should also all acknowledge the Jezebel within, you know, that we all have I think Revelation is a resistance document. I really agree with you. And I have to be aware of my own resistance within me to what it is that Christ wants to do in me and in my part in the larger enterprise of the church. That I myself participate in one way or another in some of that resistance. And that helps to keep the circle large for us to stay within it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it doesn't appear that John sees the Jezebel within himself, really, does it? But it's a wonderful book. I mean, we need people like this. I mean, I don't want in any way mute the critique, but thanks. I think that's helpful. Others?
I think hearing over you when you said how much should you resist culture, and I think there's an important distinction of resisting what may be dangerous in culture and what may be helpful in culture. And in a church that I attended, at one of the meetings, congregational meetings, was, should we offer health insurance to the parish assistant?
Huh.
And there were quite a few people who said, no, let her be put on her husband's health insurance. And I said, wait a minute. And there was really quite a resistance for that culture, that there was still a belief that a parish assistant is A, married, and two, a female.
Huh.
And not realizing that in this culture that it could be A, a male, and two, a single parent, and you need help. So to me, that's not a dangerous assimilation of a culture, whereas if somehow be promoted spouse beating, that would be
right. Yeah.
A little bit more dangerous.
No, that's an important point. And, you know, reading... Anybody who comes out of fundamentalist tradition, you know, you see how a lot of the resistance to culture was really sort of some funny things, even. That what you're talking about accounts for why pastors are still allowed to opt out of Social Security if they think they need to for conscience reasons, because it's this idea that insurance, for some people, insurance, the whole idea of insurance is somehow anti-theological, because we shouldn't be insuring ourselves against anything. But yeah, that one sounds like that's a real it's a way to try to get a parish assistant on the cheap, right? And that tends to be a very Christian response to a lot of things.
Yes. To me, it's too also it speaks to me of just think about it rather than just going along. It's like, you know, sometimes it takes someone who's so strong or has such, you know, boundaries to actually think about it rather than just passively kind of following the culture. You know, I experience that a lot with, you know, my daughter. It's like, think about it rather than just going along, whether it's culture or, you know, your peer group or whatever. Really think about it, you know.
Uh-huh. John?
It seems like one of the things that happens when diversity is heightened is our anxiety is heightened also. And it seems like we often, especially in this era, move to the lowest common denominator of threat, where we're going to feel the most comfortable. And I think our congregations often are ill-prepared to deal with that challenge. So we divide ourselves up into socioeconomic groupings, cultural groupings. I think it's a big challenge how we heighten the diversity without letting our anxiety drive us into conflict and into cutoff, to use the psychological language.
Yeah, because there's no question that what the churches that grow are the ones that provide answers. And that means not saying, you know, sort of on the one hand this, on the other hand that, but, you know, they want answers. And the book of Revelation needs to be a book of answers. And it can be. But I think, you know, then how we have to respond is the answer isn't specific, you know, facts on this or that. The answer is a relationship with God. I mean, that's, just come back to that. That's where we have our certainty, is knowing that we are beloved of God. And on all the specific little ethical issues, we don't have that same kind of exact answers, but we don't need that because we cling to a relationship. Otherwise, yeah, the diversity is very anxiety producing.
I came to an uneasy peace with the vilification throughout the whole book of Revelation a few years ago by comparing it with the process of therapy, where it is really important to say exactly how you felt about something that you're dealing with. And it's possible to say, you know, I would have loved to have murdered my mother or whatever. I mean, the language is outlandish. But you have to make a distinction between, I felt this way, these were my needs, this was the horrible situation for me, and I would never actually pick up my sword and do it. And so my uneasy piece with Revelation was it can be a useful document for people marginalized and oppressed because it is so honest, including the rage and the fury. But the danger is when people see it as a manifesto for action and uh-huh. say, because I feel this way, then I'm going to do this.
Uh-huh.
So that's why it's an uneasy piece. I think it's a really honest, helpful writing from that, from the point of view of really saying how it feels. But not from the point of view of mandating action.
Thanks, that's really important. And I think that's where the fact that it's written by people who don't have the power even to carry out what the vengeance sounds like makes it very different from when Revelation gets put in the hands of the powerful who actually could do the program that seems to be laid out there. It's a big difference.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And even in the book itself, it's interesting that it's only God who acts. The people don't act, they don't pick up arms and fight, and that's sort of, whenever there's something done, some act of justice or judgment, it's God who does the act.
Right, exactly, and I'm going to talk more about that. I think it's really important to see that even though it sounds like a violent book in terms of the projection that Joan's talking about and stuff, in fact, there is no call to violence on the part of the people. In Revelation 19, which is the closest you would get to it, it's not any kind of call to arms. Revelation 17, 16 is another one. It's not. In fact, the violent sounding of it might be a kind of cathartic psychological thing. That's what an Old Testament scholar on Revelation at the University of Chicago named Adela Yarbrough Collins calls it. Her book is called Crisis and Catharsis. And she calls it sort of cathartic so that you actually won't act it out. And in fact, I think that's part of what's going on with the violent sounding kind of imagery. It's precisely so that we won't act it out, but we're getting it out of ourselves.
Like anger management.
Yeah, that's her argument. Uh-huh. The model, I mean, and this idea of diversity, I mean, I think we have to really talk about it, but Holden is a great place to talk about it. The Greek word that was used for churches, the Greek word that we translate as church is the word ekklesia, which means sort of literally in Greek, it's kind of like town meeting. So it's not saying sort of anything goes in a kind of individualistic sort of congregation where you've got, you know, the 9 o'clock seeker service, the 10:30 shop around, I don't know, you know, all the different, it's not sort of let's try everything, let's get everybody in, let's have a sort of market approach to religion at all. Ecclesia was the town meeting where people would sit down in the democratic assembly. Well, you're a classic scholar. What's ecclesia?
The etymology,
because it's not a Christian word originally. The Christians picked it up. It originally came out of Greek classic culture.
Called out, yeah, town hall, town assembly, called out.
Ecclesia, called out. Now, the ecclesia in the Greek city-states included only free men. Women weren't included and slaves weren't included, so we as Christians want to be more inclusive. But it was this idea of participatory kind of democracy. And that's the word that Christians chose to talk about church, about what we do together, is this kind of participatory community or democracy or town meeting. So it's not an anything goes, but it's also not going to war with all those with whom you disagree. It's rather sitting down with them, worshiping together, having some things in common, the Lord's Supper, our common baptism, and then being able to embrace diversity and discuss where we disagree. I think we need to figure out how to be more ecclesia in our congregations and less sort of vilifying of one another. And indeed, the word ecclesia is right here in the book of Revelation. I mean, every time he says John to the seven churches that are in Asia, it's John to the seven ecclesias that are in Asia. This is the word that Christians chose to talk about what we do as church. And it's a way, I think, can be a model for disagreeing and holding together diverse perspectives without, on the one hand, killing everybody with whom we disagree, or on the other hand, sliding down the slippery slope of sort of anything goes, you know, whatever you think is God is okay, you know, and what, you know. It's not like that at all, but it's a way of not necessarily having to follow John whenever he vilifies someone with whom he disagrees, because I find that to be a problematic aspect of this book. Okay, I need to let you go to coffee. Let me say, tomorrow, I'll just plot a little bit of the book because I know some of you have to leave. Tomorrow starts the classic sort of apocalyptic aspects of Revelation. Chapters 1 through 3 have been down here on the ground, down on Earth. If Earth is this level. In chapter 4, we go up into the divine throne room, up into heaven. And from that point on, there's these sort of two layers tracking through the book of Revelation, heaven and earth. This is where the songs take place. This is, you know, where we get the hallelujah chorus, the worthy is the Lamb. Those are sung up in heaven. We haven't had any songs yet in chapters 1 through 3, but chapter 4. And then, like I said, in chapter 21, where God descends to earth, then I don't think heaven is anymore a part of Revelation because God's home or dwelling place comes to be on earth. But we're going to make our way through the book this week and look at these different sections and see how the genres of apocalypse and others are used. Today we especially looked at letters, but the apocalypse starts in chapter 4 and it gets really exciting and also really wild and crazy. So that's what's in store for tomorrow. Thanks.